Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is April 24th. We're recording for next week, and I'm joined by Dr. Joseph Farrell, who needs no introduction on the Solari Report. Tonight we're talking about physics, planets, power, and the reinvention of money. And that title was inspired by my reading of two really extraordinary books by Joseph. I call them contributions. They're part of a series. The next one's coming. Hold on for more. They're part of a series that Joseph began after the financial crash and the bailouts. The first one, Babylon Banksters, The Alchemy of Deep Physics, High Finance, and Ancient Religion, was published in 2009, and then Financial Vipers of Venice was published in 2010. We're going to be talking about those two books and the third coming in months, several months, and Joseph will tell you more about it. And I wanted to have this conversation this evening because these books are extraordinary in helping you understand the very deep issues behind money. Money is only a piece of a governance system, and you can't begin to think about understanding how money works, let alone proposing changes in how it works, unless you understand it as part of that bigger governance system and the deep values and sort of mechanics behind it. And I think Joseph does a very good job of fleshing that out, and I think that's invaluable for understanding a lot of the things we're seeing and watching that are going on financially on this planet. So Joseph does a lot to go into the history of these issues, and that history and the tying into the deeper issues is extremely valuable to understanding current events and where we're going as a global financial system. So with no further ado, Joseph, welcome back to the Solari Report.
Thanks for having me back, Catherine. Excited to be here.
Okay, so Babylon Banksters. Why don't you give us an overview of Babylon Banksters, and we'll begin with, you know, following that with why physics and money are so integral to each other.
Well, I conceived of this kind of mini series of books about banking and the history of the relationship between finance and physics a couple of years before the bailouts actually occurred. You know me, I kind of plan out my books a long time in advance of where I'm actually writing. And I conceived of Babylon's Banksters as trying to get people into the habit of mind of thinking about the banking system as something very old and very studied, and of the banking management class as a class that's been around for a while and is very practiced and competent at what they do. And then Financial Vipers of Venice, I had actually conceived of that book while I was writing Babylon's Banksters, and then I'm planning on a third book eventually in the series that will, I hope, carry the story forward to Stockholm and Amsterdam and the founding of the first modern central banks, and then on, of course, to the Bank of England and eventually the Federal Reserve. But there is a third book, as you mentioned, that's kind of a hidden text to Financial Vipers of Venice that'll be coming out in a couple of months, that's called The Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age, and that kind of goes into the hidden text, deep politics story behind what I talk about in Financial Vipers of Venice. Babylon's Banksters is really a book where I try and expose the relationship between what I'm calling open systems of physics and open systems of finance, because the two are definitely entangled up in each other. And as you very, very carefully pointed out, and I'm so glad you did, that when we look at a system of money, we're also looking at a system of governance. And I would understand a system of governance to include the general cultural aspects of a society as well as the actual mechanisms and agencies of government itself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And Babylon's Banksters, what I'm attempting to do there is to show how ancient systems that evolved in Mesopotamia primarily, but to a lesser extent in Egypt, how these systems of money moved from what I would call real money to what I call in Babylon's Banksters the facsimile of money, which is a kind of system of monetized debt, which is what we have now. And concomitant and concurrent with that movement from a system of money that's based on the actual surplus of a state warehouse back then to a system of monetized debt in bullion, which is very interesting. Whenever you see bullion as a system of backing for financial systems in ancient times, what you're dealing with is monetized debt. And when you look at Babylon in particular, you're dealing with financial systems that are very cleverly moved, and I think deliberately so, from a system of basically clay tablets, you know, the Babylonian equivalent of paper money, which were simply, to put it in modern terms, were simply bills of exchange drawn on the state warehouse. So in other words, we were dealing effectively with debt-free money that was issued by the state, and oftentimes in the form of loans. These loan tablets also circulated as kind of a private monetized debt money. And then eventually what you see happen in Mesopotamia is the movement to bullion. And this movement, interestingly enough, occurs at approximately the same time that you see the rise of the big empires, Alexander, of course, and before him the Persian Empire. These were all bullion-backed empires. And what they did, interestingly, is they created an ancient version of a military-industrial complex. And it gets to the point when you study this stuff, and I pick up on that story in Financial Vipers of Venice as well. What is created is an international bullion brokering class, if I can put it that way. And this system of money, in turn, means that you have to raise large armies, pay them in specie, because this is the only kind of currency that would be accepted internationally. In other words, you can't exchange a Babylonian clay tablet if you're doing business with India, because it's not going to do any good in India. But you can do it with bullion. So what this does is you create the need for a big military to go invade countries, enslave people to mine the bullion, to pay the big armies to go into countries and enslave people to mine the bullion. So in other words, you get caught in this, what one person that I researched called the coinage slavery military complex. You get locked into this cycle. And we've kind of been in this cycle ever since then.
Well, I would add one thing. What happened in Europe, which didn't happen in Asia, because I'll never forget reading Sun Tzu and trying to understand, you know, why is this so different than Western military philosophy? And I realized, oh, it's unbelievably energy efficient. And then I realized, oh, they didn't have a bond market. So the Europeans developed a bond market, which meant they could leverage the thing. And then they could add, you know, when they added derivatives, then we really went to the moon, literally. And so, you know, by creating a bond market, you basically talk the population into going along with the war way before they have to start paying. So,
this is the other thing that when you mention this, that we need to understand something that becomes a profound question the further we advance in history. And this goes way back again, of course, to Mesopotamia, because it's been part of the Western legal financial tradition ever since ancient times that the power of issuance of money rests with the crown. In other words, it rests with the government itself. It doesn't rest with a private group or a private interest. So money, it's not just what money represents, it's who it represents. That's very, very important here. And
who controls, who decides, right?
Exactly. And what you see happening over time in ancient times is as this bullion broker class is created, this class becomes an international class, much like the modern day international merchant banker. They become an international class, beholden more or less only to themselves, and manipulating governments behind the scenes by means of fiscal policy. So, you know, we're dealing with a very, very old game here, and it's very interesting that one of the steps that was taken in ancient times to legitimize this transference or this change of money from bills of credit to bullion and to a kind of monetized debt-based system was precisely the alliance of this bullion brokering class with the temple, with religion, because this gave it the probity that it needed to have its financial medium accepted by the public. So it's a very complex story, and I kind of pick it up there in Babylon's Banksters. By the time you get to Venice, you see this trend not only has repeated itself, but it's added a lot of nuances that, that I'm sure we'll get.
Right. One of the things I wanted to add when I, because I thought the description of the relationship with the temple is very interesting and very well done in Babylon Banksters. I'll never forget getting walking into the port of New Orleans, and you have the big cathedral right down there. And I thought, well, you know, if I was the pirates, you know, sailing in and docking in New Orleans, where would I want to hide my gold? And I said, oh, underneath the church. Perfect. Of course. No wonder the cathedral's down here. But I think, you know, one of the things I would stress is the hardest thing in the world for the international bankers is to come up with a governance system that really works,
right,
for governing the currency and the money. And one of the reasons you align it with the temple is, you know, not everything can be determined by price. You need to have law and you need to have a strategic framework.
Yes.
So you got to get everybody to agree to some kind of higher purpose and thinking than just price. And, you know, it's by dragging them into the temple and those philosophies that, you know, the Masons didn't go all the way into the temple. They were trying to get out of the church. But,
right,
you know, if you look at their philosophy, it's the same thing. You're trying to get everybody to stay in a higher mind, because otherwise you won't govern the money. The money will govern you and it'll fall apart.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the things that struck me about the movement of the financial class and its alignment to the temple was precisely this ability to manipulate the culture, whatever it was that they were in at the time, be it Babylon, be it Egypt, or for that matter, Asia. And another pattern that we need to mention here while I'm thinking about it with respect to ancient times is that bullion, very early on as a medium of exchange, is very quickly tied to a bimetallic ratio. In other words, when we're talking about bullion, I want people to understand that we're dealing not just with gold, but with silver. And it's very, very interesting once you get into the study of the ancient manifestation of this bimetallic system, is that Asia more or less, and I emphasize more or less, consistently valued silver over the long term much higher than it did gold. Whereas the West tended to the opposite valuation. It tended to value gold more.
I'm not sure it would be that way currently. Today, I think gold is has transformed in Asia.
But my point here is that what it really is an indicator is that you have this bullion brokering class manipulating bullion prices on both ends of the spectrum, both in Asia and in the West.
Oh yeah, they're trading the gold silver ratio back and forth.
Absolutely.
To great advantage. Yeah.
To great advantage to themselves. And in Financial Vipers of Venice, as you know, I point out how this was very deliberately manipulated by Venice to the destruction of some of its major competitors. So it's a huge story. It begins in terms of our modern system. I think it begins there in Mesopotamia, where you have two competing views of what money is, and who it represents, and more or less we've been struggling with that set of alternatives ever since then.
Yeah, it's basically, do we want closed or open, fiat or gold? You know, those are the big choices on the matrix. One of the things I wanted to mention, because there are a couple things about Venice which are very, very interesting. You know, you're talking about a very small city-state who had enormous impact. And one of the reasons is, if you look at the old Venetian banks, they essentially invented double-entry bookkeeping at the same time the printing press got started. And the combination of double-entry bookkeeping plus the printing press, you know, that was a very explosively powerful information technology.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now let's pause here and talk about Venice here in this respect very, very carefully. The man that invented, and I did not talk about this in Financial Vipers of Venice, and I didn't talk about it to a purpose, because there's a possible and, in my opinion, probable hidden history that lies behind this that I get into in the book that's now at the publishers called Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. The man that is credited with inventing double entry accounting is a Venetian mathematician by the name of Pacioli, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And he actually wrote a mathematical treatise on how this system of accounting worked, all right? It became basically the bedrock for modern accounting systems. Now, the trouble is, this is coming out of the clear blue. There's no preparation for it, at least as far as the public history is concerned. And I'm going to clue your listeners in here to something that's in the new book that most people won't find out about until a couple months from now. I strongly suspect that this accounting system was around for much longer and was a tightly held secret.
Oh, I agree.
Prior to the Venetian revelation of it. And the reason I think this is that when you look at Venice's tapestry of alliances in the Middle Ages, guess who they are consistently and traditionally allied with? The Templars.
Tell me. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
The Templars.
Yeah, and I think the Templars were using it long before.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Because when you look at what the Templars are doing, they have taken a cue from their contacts with the Islamic world and used the Islamic conception of the note of hand, which is essentially a check, to deposit funds in one preceptory at a Templar house in Europe and then withdraw them at another.
Mm-hmm.
So to do this, you have to have an international system of communications, of couriers, and most importantly, of accounting. And I personally, Catherine, just don't see any way that they could have managed the vast amounts of money that were flowing through Templar preceptories at the time without some sort of modern system of accounting to do it. And I think this is where probably the Venetian understanding of double entry accounting comes from. Now, there's lots more to this Templar-Venetian alliance that I don't really want to talk about until the new book is out, so that people can see the big picture of what's going on. And trust me, folks, it's huge. When we look at the Templars and when we look at the banks on the Rialto in Venice, in Venice we have the first real modern system of deposit banking. In other words, banks were actually handling accounts payments within the city of Venice simply on ledgers. There was no exchange of specie or anything else in their transactions within Venice itself. This was all done by simple ledger entry and so on and so forth. Now, the Templars, when you look at what the Templars are, they are a huge international military industrial intelligence banking complex. That's exactly what they are. And what they make possible for the first time in the Middle Ages is the intergenerational accumulation of capital. And again,
across place. It's not just intergenerational accumulation of capital, but it's across place in a non-family form. In a non-family form, right.
Absolutely. And right. This means that you have an enormous mechanism that creates an enormous amount of liquidity that you can actually follow. You can actually follow the flows of liquid capital within the Templar Order and understand a bit about European history and what's really going on behind the textbook descriptions of the history. So it's very, very important. And Venice, the interesting thing here to note, Catherine, is that when the Templar Order is eventually suppressed by Philippe le Bel, beginning in 1307 and then finally with the official suppression in 1313, right smack dab in the middle of this, in 1310, Venice creates its notorious Council of Ten. Now, the reason that I think these two events have to be related is that the Council of Ten becomes Venice's intelligence agency. It becomes the substitute mechanism for what they perceive as the loss of their international contacts and networks with the Templars. So, and in many cases, interestingly enough, the Templars are simply rolled into the Council of Ten. So, that's another part of the story. So, yeah, we're looking at the creation here in the Middle Ages of a system of international finance, of a system of international intelligence gathering, and finally, of course, we're looking at an international military industrial complex, because fielding knights in battle, of course, is a very expensive proposition at the time. So
Right. We're
looking at all of this with the Templars, and the Venetians are the ones supplying the Templars their ships. So,
to me, there's a very important piece to this, and it's one that's not often understood, and you rarely see it discussed today, because, you know, in many respects, to me, insurance within the financial system, it's the insurance that rules the world.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if your insurance goes bankrupt, then your equity can get wiped out. You know, think of it like on your home. If you know.
This is the other thing I think that people have to understand is that the modern insurance business is really, as you said, a Venetian creation.
Right.
And we have talked earlier about space and the collateralization of space. And I've been mentioning to people off and on that what effectively we see being done with the collateralization of space now is precisely the Venetian model, where you are collateralizing the return on your investment or financing of an expedition, a trading expedition, in return for a stake in the spoils of whatever it is that you bring back or whatever it is that you find out there. And this is exactly what we're doing. And on top of this, of course, the Venetians are adding their insurance to it. So, yeah, the model that we're looking at today is essentially, believe it or not, a Renaissance model of doing things.
Well, I'll never forget the first time the only time I've been to Venice. I had a room next to the Grand Canal. And, you know, Venice is very, when you think about it, it's a small city-state, and it's trying to get independent again. I don't know if you saw the recent vote, but but it's a small place, and, of course, it is always fighting with the ocean. And I woke up, and I could hear the ocean literally lapping against the building, and I could hear in my mind it whispering, risk, risk, risk. And I realized, here you are, you're a relatively small group of people in a relatively small place. And what you can do is, you've built this merchant ship and navy capacity, and you're sailing the world trying to trade. And how did this tiny group of people get to be so powerful and so influential? And part of it was, you know, their whole approach to risk. Good and bad, right and wrong. So, the insurance to me is a big piece of it.
It's not only that, but we see something else happening with Venice. And again, this is a model that I think you can trace back in certain respects to Babylonian times. And that is that Venice becomes really the first good modern exemplar of mercantilist policy, because there is nothing that is done in Venice that is not involving both agencies of the state itself and special privileges that the Venetian oligarchs managed to wrest not only from their own state, but from the states that they're trading with. Venice really gets its start with something that's called the Golden Bull that was issued by the Eastern Roman Emperor in 1082, which granted Venice special trading privileges and tax exemptions within Constantinople. So you had, of course, the rise of the Venetian Quarter, and then later, of course, the Genoese got into that act. You had the rise of the Venetian Quarter in Constantinople that leads ultimately, of course, to the Fourth Crusade and Venice's role in sacking the city. So we see that emerge as a typical policy of the financial elite at that time. And again, this is something they've been following ever since.
Well, let's step back and shift, because I want to talk about physics and the cycle of waves. You turn in Babylon Banksters to talk about fundamental physics, how the planets work, and and discuss, you know, a way of looking at the behavior that we experience on the planet, in the economy, the planets to each other, that really starts to go at the fundamental issues that need to be understood in terms of our geophysical and sort of, well, it's both the visible and the invisible, how the energy in the universe works and what that means to the economy and therefore the design of the financial system.
Well, by closed systems of physics, I mean essentially a system of energy where you are reliant on non-renewable energy sources, and also a system of energy where the coefficient of performance of return on any work done in that energy system never approaches, much less surpasses, unity. So in other words, you know, you put X amount of energy into a system, be it a financial system or be it a machine, and you get X minus N energy out of it. So you're always in a losing game in that kind of energy system.
You get built-in entropy physically.
You've got built-in, yes, precisely. You've got built-in physical entropy in the system. And when you wed the finance aspect to it, what you have is built-in entropy in the system of finance, and also, by necessity of the case, you have a closed system of finance that's in the hands of a very few. So, in my mind, this is the first thing that people have to understand. When you go back to ancient times and to the kinds of economies that were running very efficiently on debt-free money, they were, in a certain sense, closed systems in that they could not successfully conduct much international commerce, even though they had successful domestic economies. Once debt instruments began to be traded as actual media of exchange, the situation arose that the energy system that you were basing all of this on was human labor, actual slave labor. So you would actually collateralize your children sometimes in loans, and if you couldn't repay the loan, then, you know, they'd come in and take your children and put them, you know, into debt slavery. And this led to the complete breakdown of society, because as debts mounted, the ability of society to maintain its agricultural production and its manufacturing production dwindled, so that you had the institution within Mesopotamia of the years of Jubilee. The kings would come out and literally perform the ceremony of the breaking of the tablets. And what that meant was all debts were canceled. It was, you know, pushing the reset button, because society couldn't function without it. And again, this is kind of a closed system. Now, the other thing that we have to understand, and I realize I'm going around Harvey's barn on this, but it's to a purpose. In ancient times, the temple that the bullion brokers ally themselves to, the temple is primarily in the hands of priests that are proficient in astrological, astronomical prediction. And whether we like it or not, the ancients believed that they could predict the horoscopes, what are called mundane horoscopes in modern terms, for a nation. In other words, a horoscope wasn't something that you predicted for an individual like you find today when you go into the shopping line at the grocery store and see, you know, these little sun sign books in the aisle. That's not what they were doing. They were predicting aggregate horoscopes for an entire nation, for the king.
For large systems.
A large system, exactly.
Right.
And you find records of this in the Bible, of course, with Joseph making his predictions about, you know, coming years of famine, so we'd better store up, and lo and behold, it happens, and he gains Pharaoh's approval. So this is very much part of the ancient way of thinking. And what they're really saying here is something very interesting. If you step back from astrology and think of it in more modern terms, what they're really talking about are cycles.
Right.
Boom and bust cycles. Now, I became interested in this because when I was researching Babylon's banksters, I made a very, very interesting discovery, and that was an almost unsung legacy of President Hoover from the Great Depression. Hoover, of course, had this very laissez-faire attitude. You know, the government should not get involved in trying to sort out the mess that has resulted from the Depression. But Hoover did do one thing. He demanded from the U.S. Department of Commerce that it come up with an explanation for why we keep going through these boom and bust cycles. And he appointed a man by the name of Edward Dewey to study this and report to him on what he found. Dewey began investigating cycles of almost every conceivable thing that you can imagine. Rubber production, soybean production, skyscraper construction, you know, any sort of activity that showed a cyclical behavior pattern. And when he compiled all this, he was rather stunned at what he discovered, because he discovered long wave cycles of, you know, 9 years, of 18 years, even a cycle of 54 years, where there were these long, long waves of boom and bust, and that these appeared to him to be part of a physics rather than something that human action, government policy, or anything like that could fight against. The best, he said, that we can do is to understand when we're entering a cycle that our policy might be able to exacerbate that cycle or ameliorate it, but it can never, ever damp it completely.
It's too powerful.
It's extremely powerful, because what he's really saying is that there's a physics, there is a huge macro physics that we don't understand because it has never been given adequate attention. That there's a huge macro...
That we know of.
That we know of. That we know of, exactly.
Right.
That is behind financial cycles. Now, when I read this, I said, well, this is exactly the same thing that the ancients thought, that there's some sort of cosmological connection to financial activity in the aggregate that is part of a deep physics that they may have understood much better. And as I began investigating this, I discovered that during all four major American depressions, there's been an astrological configuration called the Grand Cross that has either occurred during them or that has shortly preceded them. Now, Dewey went on, this is the interesting part of the story. Dewey went on to found a little known foundation. It's still in existence in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. And that's all they do. They study cycles of every conceivable thing you can think of. I've seen some of their literature. But the interesting thing, Catherine, is I discovered that as members presenting papers in this foundation, you had economists from things like Mitsubishi Bank.
So
in other words, the picture also began to emerge that we might be dealing with some hidden knowledge on the part of major financial institutions, that they realize that there's more to this business cycle than merely studying financial graphs and charts. That there's a physics at work that actually impacts financial activity. And I think, again, that the ancients had their finger on something here that we're only just beginning to relearn.
You know, one of the things I've always wondered is when you look at the system globally of HARP and the cell towers and the whole manipulation of the electromagnetic fields.
Yes.
To what extent are they trying to ameliorate another cross? To what extent are they trying to, you know, have they looked into the future and said, okay, we're very worried about what could happen next. We have to, if we're going to have a closed financial system and a closed energy system, we need a closed electromagnetic field that we can manipulate ourselves.
Oh boy, listen, I'm so glad you raised that. Let me crawl way out onto the end of the twig of some very high information here.
Okay.
I think you've hit the nail directly on the head of a possibility that, again, would probably boggle most people's minds, but we have to mention it because, again, this is part of that connection, that deep connection between financial systems and cosmological systems. Modern physics, with the rise of quantum mechanics, began to come up just in no uncertain terms against the materialism that had been prevalent within the physical sciences up to that point. And it did so in the following fashion, and I'm going to refer to a well-known physics principle called the uncertainty principle. And this was formulated by the German physicist Werner Heisenberg. Heisenberg pointed out that you can never measure the position of an electron at the same time as you measure its velocity. So in other words, in the act of measurement, which is so crucial to most modern physics, before you even take the measurement, you've determined to a certain extent the outcome. And this philosophical conundrum has been haunting physics ever since, because what it means is that in a very deep way, there is a connection, a direct connection between mind and matter. There is a direct connection between consciousness and the physical medium. Now, the problem there then becomes one of statistics, because what quantum mechanics really is nothing but a statistical average of all measurements of different sorts, all right? So it becomes possible to conceive in that milieu, in that context, it becomes possible to conceive of the technological manipulation of opinion precisely in order to affect a physics response. And I hope people understand the huge implications of what I've just said.
Let's say that again.
It becomes possible to conceive of the technological manipulation of consciousness in order to affect public opinion, which in turn can affect the physical medium. Okay?
Right.
Now, you've mentioned William Tiller and I think have interviewed him a couple of times on the Solari Report. And essentially, this is what he and others are discovering, that there is a very subtle mind over matter influence in play. That if
you've ever worked with financial markets that were allowed to function as financial markets, I will tell you it's not always subtle. It's huge.
We have discussed many times the manipulation of markets. Well, the most effective way of manipulating markets remains manipulating public opinion.
Right.
So again, if you're manipulating a market, you're manipulating something with a deep connection to a deep physics that's not very well understood, at least publicly. So yeah, I think that when all the chips are on the table, Catherine, we have to entertain the possibility of what you just said in your question, and that is that they could be manipulating via those types of technologies. They could be trying to manipulate financial markets in a very, very deep way. I think that's something that
falls. Well, I know they're doing that through the collection of intelligence, through the, you know, sort of the total,
sure,
total information awareness. So if you look at the NSA type systems, you know, I'm highly confident they're using that intelligence to manage the economy in a whole variety of ways and to manage the markets. But I think this is, you know, if you look at the HARP and cell tower and the entrainment, I think that's a whole nother step by manipulating the field literally and consciousness that you're,
yes, exactly,
you know, you're creating animal spirits or removing them. One of the things I wanted to point out is if you look at certainly the last 100 years and you take you know, the knowledge of energy and then money and then governance and then physics, you'll see some innovator come along and start to fiddle with one. And suddenly, whack, they get whacked. And part of it is they don't understand that when you fiddle with one piece on one of them, you're potentially fiddling with all of them at the same time. And the people running things can't afford for you to do that, and they can't afford to explain that to you.
Exactly.
So,
well, this,
yeah.
Exactly. This is the ultimate reason why there are so many stories of this inventor or that inventor having invented something new in terms of energy technologies, where they're getting coefficients of performance that are close to unity or over unity in their inventions. And of course, we've all heard the physics song and dance, well, that's impossible. But it's not impossible when you consider physics to be not based on closed systems and inevitable entropy, but on open systems that can locally self-organize. And, you know, this is the whole principle behind cold fusion and things like this. And that, in turn, when you are inventing energy sources like that, you're saying that the cosmology is wrong. And when you're saying the cosmology is wrong, you're saying the financial system based on that cosmology is wrong. You can't tinker with the one without tinkering with the other.
There are two things I wanted to ask you about before we go on. One is, I wanted to tell you a story. When I was, I had in my last company in Washington, Hamilton Securities, I had hired what was then AT&T Bell Laboratories to take the optimization methodology that they use to route telephone calls,
right,
to help me apply it to mortgage transactions that would allow, you know, thousands and thousands of people bid in non-conforming ways, and we could optimize. And it was quite dramatic because for the first time we were able to bid the real estate, the mortgage, and the securities market off against each other. So the famous line was the head of the real estate portfolio at the Harvard Endowment calling me, or me calling him, and he picked up the phone and said, F you, I hate you. I said, why is that? And he said, we can only win if we bid higher. We don't like that.
Right.
Anyway, so, but one of the things that was fascinating was I had the chance to spend a lot of time with the guys who did the modeling, sort of the quants, and they had taken the optimization technology and applied it to scheduling airline crews, because with airline crews, you have very complex preferences over long periods of times and complex scheduling. And what they were able to do after many years was they suddenly had a database that would tell you, okay, how much did a rule cost? You know, because the unions would negotiate rules. And then you could see in very incredible ways, what did that rule cost you? And one of the things they discovered, you had pilots who had seniority. What they discovered was that the seniority of the pilots so constrained the system that if you remove those seniority, you remove those privileges, the pilots would get more of what they wanted.
Ah.
The closed system had so constrained the optimization that the most privileged class lost because of the strangulation of the optimization. And
right.
I looked at that and I said, that is the price of privilege. That is how privilege can destroy the optimization of an economy or system. Now, hold that thought. Let me just say one other thing. As you know, whenever I study finance and look at different financial systems, not just now but through the history, it looks to me the only thing I can, you know, intuit is that there is a tithe, and literally the whole financials, you know, the whole globe is being harvested. It's almost as though everybody on the planet is obligated to pay a 10% tithe, and they're constantly on the treadmill trying to come up with this money. And part of the entropy in the system is not just the closed system, whether it's the debt or the privilege or the closed energy and the closed physics, but producing this harvest. Because I think part of the reason you may need a closed system is because somebody's got the power to force you to produce that tithe. Why do we have a planetary tithe, Joseph?
Well, we've always had, and this is the problem. Again, if you go back to ancient times, you find, of course, the idea of a tithe in the Old Testament. You find during the Middle Ages the idea of Peter's pence, which is something that you pay directly to the papacy to sustain its international operations. And again, you find the tithe in Mesopotamia. You find it in Egypt. And the whole thing arises, interestingly enough, I think, as far as I can tell, at least now, more or less at the same time as you find the rise of this international bullion brokering class that allies itself, guess what, with the temple, which is receiving what? The tithe.
Right.
So this idea of harvesting the globe to sustain something, which in effect is, in ancient times, you know, the military-industrial coinage slavery complex. This is not new. It's been the way that these huge bureaucracies, intelligence services, military machines, and establishments have been sustained since ancient times. So there's nothing new there. I think what we've added in our discussions, Catherine, is that this has now reached such huge dimensions. It had to reach huge dimensions because it was created for the express purpose of managing the Cold War crisis, first of all, by funding covert operations with a nearly inexhaustible supply of totally off-the-books money. But much more importantly, since we're dealing with a system which contains trillions, if not quadrillions, of dollars, that this was created to fund research to deal with the UFO problem. So again, this tithe, I think, is there because there is a global crisis that is hidden from us that the post-war national security establishment had to deal with, and that was the problem of the UFO. So again, this may sound crazy, it may sound the wildest kind of fantasy, but the reality is that this is there. It did happen. They did put that system into place, and this system has erected and expanded on the ancient tithing system to a tremendous degree to support that research and respond to the problem. So, you know, we cannot, and I'm so solidly with you on this analysis that we cannot really begin to understand the modern financial world unless we understand the UFO problem, because the two are so intimately related. And again, that's just another way of saying that finance and physics and cosmology are all inextricably bound.
It's one human system, right?
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things I wanted to mention was I thought you did a very good job of describing the sort of merger after the World War II of the Nazi International with the Anglo-American Alliance.
Right.
You know, you take these two systems who, and part of what I hadn't understood, because I just finished reading the Reich of the Black Sun, was I had never understood until I read your work, Joseph, the bargaining chips that Bormann had coming into the end of the war. I had always underestimated the contribution of the German technology to sort of brokering that deal and the balance of power afterwards.
Yeah.
And when you describe in Babylon Banksters how you come together you know, the two come together into the Bilderbergers and sort of this new governance structure.
Yeah.
And you realize that in combination, these folks really do have the capital and the technology to basically get everybody in the model. And if you look at what's been going on since then, you know, you've seen, I just wrote an article called Musings on the News, and I describe, you know, coup d'etat after coup d'etat. You're literally watching covert forces go around the planet and get everybody into the model. And clearly we're coming into the end game, because if you look at the people who are outside the central banking system run essentially by this group, you know, we're down to a very small handful of people out. And I think one of the reasons you see Putin, you know, pushing so hard is he's trying to keep a couple people out of the model.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely. And, you know, this is the other part of the story that people have to understand. What you're describing with the Bilderbergers is a thesis I put out there in the beginning of Babylon's Banksters. Because let's look at this so that we can understand what Putin is, what he's up to. The Bilderberg meeting was on the Western side, brokered primarily by the Rothschilds and Lawrence Rockefeller, with David in the background. And on the European side, of course, it was Prince Bernhard and another fellow who was a prominent member of the early Bilderberg meetings almost consistently, and that was Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who was the CEO of Deutsche Bank, all right? Now, Bernhard, most people are unaware that Bernhard was in management of IG Farben, okay? So in other words, this guy was plugged into the financial structure of the Third Reich in a very, very major way. And with Hermann Josef Ops, we have another individual who was plugged into that structure, because during and prior to the war, Ops ran a handling bank in Berlin that handled all of the Reich government accounts. In other words, this was the guy signing Adolf Hitler's paycheck as chancellor. Okay. So in other words, we're dealing with people coming together, in my opinion, Catherine, to coordinate all of this vast Nazi loot that's been moved into Western banks. I suspect what they did was they kept it off the books as a hidden reserve in order to expand the post-war credit-making ability. That's exactly what we saw happened. And I think the reason it happened is it was based on all this plundered Axis loot, okay, which was then cycled back into Europe with everybody making their own cut. Now, this is a story that has to be known by the Russians, and in particular by Mr. Putin, coming as he does out of the KGB. And the Russians, it's interesting to note that Mr. Putin himself did his PhD thesis precisely in areas of economies, markets, and finance. So in other words, he's very well aware of what this post-war financial game has been, and I think this explains why he has so carefully and decisively and successfully positioned Russia as a major energy player on the world stage and is bucking this trend. I suspect something else very interesting in Russia's case, and I want to mention this episode to your listeners because it's part of this hidden technology game that is so affecting modern finance. In the aftermath of the Ukrainian crisis, the United States Navy sent one of its Aegis-class frigates into the Black Sea. And very recently, a Russian, I think it was a Sukhoi or Tupolev bomber, buzzed this ship 12 times. Now, the story is that this bomber approached the Aegis-class frigate on radar. Okay, they saw it coming. And then it completely disappeared off their radar and buzzed the ship 12 times while it was not being detected by the ship's radar. So Russia's sending us a message. We have these antiquated B-52-sized bombers too, and we can make them go completely blank from your radar systems. So the financial game is plugged into the technological game that we see now being played out, I think, on the world stage between the West and Russia, and people need to be very, very aware of this, because this is notching up the pressure that's now being put on space as the next battleground for reserve currency status. You've been saying that all along. I think this
right.
is another little indicator. We have the Chinese president coming out very recently and saying that China, you know, just came right out and said China wants to militarize space. That's that's it.
Right.
And the target here is precisely this closed system of economy and cosmology that is in place in the West with the central banking model. That's precisely their target. Now, that has its own implication, and I hope people heard what it was, since we're talking about ancient systems and closed systems and open systems and the relation of cosmology and physics to finance. Because for them to do that, that means that they may also want to put into play a competing cosmology. And I hope people understood what I just said. Because if that's the case, then, you know, the game is going to change yet again, and it's going to change in a very, very significant way. Because it may mean that these countries are willing to expose, unless they get certain things that they want on the table, that they're negotiating now with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it may mean that these countries are willing to expose some of these hidden energy technologies for themselves.
And right.
I want to warn people here. Russia has been in the forefront, although very, very secret about it. They don't widely publicize what they're up to, but Russia has been in the forefront for a very long time of investigating alternative systems of energy, alternative ideas in physics. They have been big investigators in the realm of cold fusion and how that's related to biophysics, biological processes. So they may be willing to stake their money on a cosmology based on biological rather than a mechanistic view of cosmology. And again, that would change the game tremendously if they did that. So this is a huge thing. And again, I'm simply trying to emphasize for people that merely looking at financial charts and so on and so forth is not enough. You've got to look at the big picture. You've got to look at the connection of finance and cosmology, because it's been there in the Western system, whether we like it or not, as an implicit component of that system since ancient times.
So let me bring this back to two things. One is space and one is the Snowden revelations, because what I see is the combination of the Nazi International and the Anglo-American Alliance clearly pushing for the end game.
Yeah.
And the world, you know, just a world of people pushing back, because they know as soon as those last few pieces click into place, then you're talking about an enormous shift. Now, the reality is right now we have 2 billion people on smartphones, and we're headed to, you know, at high speed to get everybody else. So we now have hundreds of millions of people getting smartphones and getting on global financial systems that don't have toilets. You know, so this is quite amazing. And I told you earlier this week that suddenly I realized, oh my God, you know, when coal, in 1989, when the wall came down, and there was a large conversation about it's going to take 10 years and many years and be very complicated and require great diplomacy to unify East Germany and West Germany. And then in 1990, they agreed as to a whole series of economic sort of cooperation. And then Kohl simply announced, okay, the Deutschmark were offering to, you know, buy in the East German currency at a very attractive rate. And ba-boom, the next day, you know, the country's unified. And I realized, oh, Kohl just tendered. He just did a friendly tender
yep.
for East Germany and bought them in a day. Ba-boom.
Yep.
And East Germany just melted in through the currency. And I realized, oh, my God, you know, we're going to give a smartphone to every person on the planet and then offer them, you know, a Google wallet or a Facebook bank account with, you know, $5 in it. And the next thing you know, we're going to add 4 billion people to the float. And we're literally going to tender for the world population. And as long as we control the internet, it's going to work.
Yeah.
And then I realized, you know, if you look at the squabble about space, we're arguing about who controls the suborbital platform and who can protect it and enforce on it. And we're also talking about who has the flow of intelligence. And so, you know, space and the Snowden revelations are very integral to this endgame around the currency. Although I think for many people it's not intuitively obvious, which is why I keep banging the drums about it.
I think you're absolutely right. What I would add to that is that when you look at what Cole did during the reunification, I think Cole was acting according to a plan.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. And the reason I say that is, again, if you go back to my book, The Nazi International, where I discuss the reunification, Cole had a minister without portfolio by the name of Gunther Strassmeier, who was a member of his party's apparatus in Berlin itself. And Strassmeier had as his mission brief to work out the plan of reunification. So in other words, the Kohl government came into power with a plan to reunify Germany, and part of that plan definitely included, as you say, this tender for the East German currency. And I think if you look back, again crawling way out onto the limb here, when you look back at what Kohl did, it is very much in keeping with what was the plan of Hitler's economics minister, a fellow by the name of Walter Funk, F-U-N-K, who basically in the early 1940s came up with the plan for the European Union. This idea of tender was precisely how he had engineered this thing to work. So again, I think, you know, the other part of this financial picture, this end game that you're talking about, is we have to factor in this historical circumstance of how much leverage the Nazis actually had at the end of the war, you know, as Germany's falling apart, but
right,
holding some whole cards in the form of some very, very sophisticated technology, which they used to barter for their post-war position and influence. And this is what we're dealing with. And I hope people understand that the fiat model of currency was very, very much a part of the Nazi way of thinking. Hitler had been profoundly influenced by an economist in Germany by the name of Georg Feder, who wanted this kind of system of public debt-free finance to be the model. And the only thing that we don't see in place is the debt-free part. That's the big bugaboo. But otherwise, we're looking at pretty much the game plan that was formulated during World War II.
Okay, so let's talk. I want to open up now to me what is one of the most important things that is at the very heart of what we're seeing evolve right now, and that is Nicholas Negroponte, when he was head of the MIT Media Lab, said, "In a digital age, data about money is worth more than money."
Yeah.
And we're in a situation where, whether you look at closed or open or fiat or bullion or otherwise collateralized, we're talking about, you know, just as the combination of double entry bookkeeping and the printing press was an unbelievably powerful innovation by the Venetians,
yep,
combining that with digital financial systems and communication systems is an equally, you know, it's a shift as big as that. Because now what we're looking at, you know, I don't know if you've looked at the Icelandic currency that they've just introduced called the Aurora, which is a digital virtual currency issued by the government that has within it a complete history of its transaction.
Oh, my.
So we're talking about 100% real-time transparency of all financial transactions to a centralized closed system.
Oh, boy. I didn't know that was that profound.
Well, to me, Bitcoin, you know, the first thing I saw when I saw Bitcoin is I said, uh-oh, they're prototyping. You know, they're making this look like it's grassroots, and they're prototyping. And what where this is going is something that will, you know, each Bitcoin or, you know, as it's going to end up, will have a complete history of every transaction from the beginning of time. And all of that data will be available in real time on a central basis.
Right.
Now, you know, you can make that a closed or open system. You can combine it with gold or other things.
Sure.
But the nature of the digital intelligence and who gets it and how. You know, it's very interesting. In 1998, I emailed or called all the Federal Reserve banks, and I said, who, you know, what contractors manage your database and information systems, and what are the policies related to member access to that data? Because if you give me access to that data, Joseph, I can rule the world.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, especially if I can turn credit on and off.
Sure.
So talk about a harvesting system. The data one of the reasons I went to HUD and did what I did was I was trying to get all the data. That was the richest motherload of data outside of the Federal Reserve System. And you know, because you've got data on every, you know, every local economy bottom up in America. Anyway, so, and they wrote back and said, that is confidential information. You're not allowed to know that. So the question is, we're now talking about a currency that is another, you know, it has a huge fundamental difference because of its digital nature. And I think that makes this endgame squabble, you know, someone like Putin is looking at that and saying, you know, it's bad enough I can't buy anything in Moscow on Visa without the information going back through New York. What is life going to be like if they launch a digital currency and you know, and somebody, you know, the European Union and the Americans have 100% real-time knowledge of every transaction going on in Russia, there will be no sovereignty.
No, of course not. And the other thing about that system is, if what you're describing is true, then the other thing about that system, Catherine, is it makes that hidden system of finance, the harvesting system, more or less permanent.
And brutal.
And brutal, yes, absolutely. It makes it more or less permanent, and it empowers whoever is in control of it over those technologies that it's purchasing secretly. It makes it virtually an unopposable monopoly. And I think when you bring Putin into the picture, this is something you and I have discussed before as well, that I think people really have to start to understand. I think you're also in danger when you have that kind of spoils at stake within the Western financial system. You are in real danger of increasing the factional infighting amongst the groups for control of it. I'm absolutely convinced that this is why we see now a quiet scramble on the part of the various space powers to beef up their space programs. You're seeing it from Germany and Europe, you're seeing it from Russia, China, and so on and so forth, because that's going to be the mechanism, as you've pointed out many times before. Who controls the hardware is going to control that information flow. So,
right.
I think you're seeing now a real competition in space emerge because of all of this. And you're right. Putin has done something else, I think, that people need to be aware of, particularly those with gods of money that are active in international markets. Putin has recently beefed up the system of domestic clearing within Russia. They want to have their own independent system up and running within a year or two. Whether they're going to be successful or not, I don't know. I suspect they will be. Eventually, I think this is going to have to be expanded to the other BRICS nations. Again, you and I have discussed this before on Solari, that the BRICS nations are going to have their own mechanisms of independent financial clearing so that they don't fall prey to this monopoly. So in other words, We're also looking at some competition emerge. It's nowhere near the size that financially the West represents, but the very fact that there is some competition has got to give those people some pause. So I think, yeah, they've got to do this in a certain sense from where I'm sitting, with having researched Nazis and their technologies and how all that played out after the war. They've got to put into place some sort of digital currency system, such as you're describing, internationally, in order for them to keep the game going. I think that's an inevitability. So
here's my question, and you know, because I've been asking this for months, and I keep calling you and asking because I'm trying to figure it out. Who's helping Putin? Because Putin's getting a lot of help. And, yeah. You know, today I was really thinking, okay, he's getting help from the United States. So there's some faction in the Anglo-American Alliance here that's helping this guy. He's getting too much help. So
I have to agree with you. And I'll tell you what my suspicion is as for where this help might be coming from. And again, I'm not trying to pick on this particular country or point fingers or anything of the sort.
Uh-huh.
But it's just by dint of its unusual geopolitical situation that I think we have to look first there, and that has to be Germany. And the reason I say that is that, as far as I can tell, Germany's balance of trade is much more heavily weighted to Asia than it is to the West. Even though Germany's locked into the Western system of finance and locked into the Western system of military alliances, its trade, on the other hand, is conducted with the East. Its energy comes from the East. So Germany is walking the same old diplomatic tightrope that has been walking since the age of Frederick the Great, playing the West off against the East off against the West. Germany's intelligence resources are rather substantial, and I suspect that if Mr. Putin is getting assistance from within some faction of the Anglo-American oligarchy, that the cutout in this case is probably Germany. You may have someone in London and New York or Washington passing information to Mr. Putin, but I don't think they're going to be doing so directly. I think it's going through Berlin somehow. And if that's the case, then the American oligarchs, the British oligarchs, are probably going to have to step up their international surveillance simply to find out who this is. And this is another thing you and I have discussed. Why the need for all this surveillance on top of the insider trading mechanism that it represents? They appear to be looking for something else, and I suspect that this may play into it somehow.
Well, that's why you keep coming back, because trying to understand this is complex enough. You keep coming back to what's because when I look at the UFOs, I mean, this is a topic where I've torn my hair out trying to understand, and it wasn't until I discovered you and Richard that I came up with people who I said, okay, well, they figured all of this out, so we can just, we'll just slip into these boxes what they say, so I can just plagiarize all of this stuff. But what I keep coming back to is, if you look at the total cost of the hardware that has been flying around around planet Earth in the form of UFOs, whether now or in ancient times,
right.
If you just look at that, I don't see overtly an industrial base developed to create them. Not to say that it couldn't exist covertly and me not know about it.
I'm in agreement there, and I don't mean to interrupt, because I think you're raising a very important point here that people have to understand. The UFO problem is a conundrum in two ways. If you look at individual UFO cases on an individual basis, it becomes very difficult in most of those cases to argue a compelling argument that these things are necessarily extraterrestrial or non-human. But when you look at the aggregate of the phenomenon. The picture changes completely because, as you say, we don't seem to have anywhere on planet Earth a production capacity that can sustain the output necessary to account for all of these reports.
Right.
And that leaves us with, as you say, that leaves us with two problems. There's either a covert manufacturing base that is so large, that is so hidden, that we don't know about. And I don't rule that out of the picture by any stretch of the imagination, as a matter of fact. Or we're looking at something that's entirely off-world, or
interdimensional.
Subterrestrial, or under the oceans, or what have you. But you're looking at a production capacity that's mystifying. And in terms of finance, of the scale of financing that we've seen involved in the derivatives crisis and so on and so forth, I mean, my word, the derivatives are in the quadrillions of dollars. So what's all that money sloshing around for? Where is it going?
Right.
You know, I said this the last time we talked, that when you put a certain amount of electricity into a circuit, it's got to come out at the load end somewhere. And the problem is that in spite of all the predictions of hyperinflation that we've been hearing since Ronald Reagan's administration, the load end doesn't appear to be appearing. This money is not appearing in the public system. That
right.
baffles me. And one explanation would be, yeah, it's being used to finance something, or it's going off world.
Right.
That's the other problem here. So, you know.
And here's where I get totally stumped. People say to me, well, what are the solutions? And I feel stumped because, you know, my father was a surgeon. One of the things he would tell you is never operate until you understand what's going on.
Right.
And
right.
you have all these people running around saying, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that. Well, if money is only part of a governance system, and if you don't understand the risks that the current governance system is dealing with, then how can you propose another governance system, let alone the financial tools within it? You can't. You're just, you know, right.
Yeah, this is why it's so important that people understand the financial aspects, the impact, the financial impact of what we're talking about with this post-war breakaway civilization idea. Now, people can laugh at that whole idea as a conspiracy theory or what have you, but a little investigation will show that that system was put into place, number one, that vast military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about was put into place. But what most people don't realize is that that system required, by the nature of the case, a huge and hidden system of finance that was totally unaccountable to Congress or any of the overt agencies of the American government.
So they turned to this International Bullion Bank group and said,
bingo.
Go to town.
Exactly.
Anything goes.
Anything goes. And what they
did,
and this is so important for people to understand, because this is where risk assessment has to start focusing. When President Truman set up that hidden system of finance in 1947 and kept it top secret, he was doing so on the basis of all of that Nazi and Imperial Japanese plunder from World War II. And we still don't know accurately how much was there. We do know it was a huge amount of money. And if this is being kept off the books, it means two things. It means, first of all, you have to have prime banks, you have to have prime brokerage houses involved in this system at some point and with some complicity. But the problem is, you can't point to any one bank and say everyone in management at this bank is involved. That's not the way it would work. It would be compartmentalized.
Right.
And
right.
the other problem is you have to understand that it's not simply the banks anymore, especially since World War II, that are at the heart of this international system of finance. It's the intelligence agencies.
Right.
And, you know, this is what puts your comment about President Putin in a very, very unique light, because this means that he's getting some profound intelligence from somewhere, probably from the Russian security services, and like you said, probably ultimately from some inside track that he has.
Oh, I think it, right. I think if you look at what happened with Snowden and a whole variety of different things, he's getting help. You know, the factionalism here, you know, it's not so simple that it's one sovereign nation against the other. There's some deep factionalism going on, and things sort out in, you know, in complex ways that we don't quite see.
Right.
So, you know, there are a lot of people who are not excited about the idea of a particular group getting dictatorial control through the currency and the financial system of everybody on planet Earth.
Well, exactly. We're seeing the public pushback from the BRICS nations, from Brazil and Russia and India and China and South Africa.
And Main Street.
And Main Street. And the problem is that I'm hoping people understand here is that by the nature of the case, you're also dealing with factions within the power structure of Western finance itself. I think this is a large part of what's going on behind all these banker suicides and strange deaths. I think this is definitely what's in play behind the scenes with the recent fracas over the Ukraine. I think it's definitely behind the scenes with what China did, sending their lunar rover and with their recent pronouncements about militarizing space. I think this whole big financial struggle is part of the deep picture here that people have to understand. And I think you're absolutely right. We cannot make prognoses or perform operations until we understand and have a better picture of what's going on and who the factions that are contending right now are. And I don't think any of us really have a very good picture of that. We're getting closer, I think, but I still don't think that we can readily sit down and identify this mafia family as fighting that mafia family. I don't think we're in that clear of a situation yet. But the other thing I think people have to understand here is the physics aspect of this. And it may be the case that we're looking at a phenomenon in physics known as self-organization of systems in non-equilibrium. And what I mean by that is if you put systems into a high state of non-equilibrium where there's more energy or potential work in one part of the system than in another, and suddenly remove the barrier that separates the systems, what happens is the two systems tend toward equilibrium, but they do so in a way that the system self-organizes. So in other words, there's no center of power. There's no all-powerful group orchestrating what's happening. It's just happening by dint of some basic physics principles. And when we add to this what we've been talking about with Babylon's banksters and financial vipers of Venice, if there is a segment within the high circles of power, within the Western financial elites that understand any aspect of this physics connection to high finance in a deeper and more profound way than does the public, then they are certainly in a position of advantage to enrich themselves in the process and perhaps possibly to preserve their own power in the process. So I think we have to look very, very carefully at big banks and how they've been exploring these systems of finance. I mentioned the Foundation for the Study of Cycles and its connection to the Mitsubishi Finance Group. I think we have to look very carefully in those areas, which are going to be very hard to find. But I think once we start looking there and begin compiling data, we're going to get a bigger and better picture of who these factions are and what they're up to.
Now, it's interesting. My experience is the banks are the bureaucracies, but they're not the real power. The real power,
right,
you know, is very much in the insurance book and in the equity leadership behind that the banks go up into the central banks, but then you have the insurance book and the equity behind it, and these various governance systems trying to make strategic decisions. And so the...
Yeah, even better, because an insurance company is going to want to study these types of deep physics connections, if there are any. They're going to want to find out if there are, and if there are, they're going to want to understand them. So even better, because an insurance company, of course, is going to be basing its actuarial tables on things like that, and it's going to take statistical analysis that is the bedrock of insurance. It's going to take that to an even deeper and much more profound level. So yeah, I think we need to. Let me put it this way. What came out of Financial Vipers and Babylon's Banksters when I was doing those books was precisely this awareness that you know, I had been under the impression, like many people, that to study financial markets, you had to concentrate on just that. But now I think the exact opposite. I think to understand those things, you have to understand the deep politics of what's going on. You have to understand the cultures involved, but most importantly, you have to understand that there's a deep physics behind all of this.
Right.
And most of us are, you know, we're not even aware that there may be that connection, and we have to start looking at that connection.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to mention, I want to talk about the book that's coming out briefly, but before we go there are two other topics I wanted to talk about.
Uh-huh.
One is you bring up the topic of DNA, which I think is very relevant and important, but maybe if you could describe why it comes up in Babylon's Banksters and why you believe it's important.
Well, Babylon's Banksters is a very strange book. I've been working from the model in any of my books that deal with ancient cultures and cosmologies. I've been dealing with the thesis, or have assumed as a model or method of analysis, that these cultures are legacy cultures. That, in other words, there was pre-existing them in high antiquity, in the mists of human prehistory, a very, very sophisticated culture with an extremely high science. And you see residues of this, particularly in Egypt, where it's very, very difficult to disentangle what they think about religion from what they think about science, from what they think about medicine, from what they think about law. It's all part of one big, huge thing. And I've been operating on the idea that these cultures in ancient times are legacies of a declined science. In other words, we're looking at an already declined, not quite as well understood science that was as equal, if not more, capable than our own in modern times. Now, with that in mind, let's look at DNA. When you look at DNA, the odd thing that pops out, and this was noticed in a certain sense by the German mathematician Leibniz, of all people. So, there's another name to throw into the mix. But when you look at human DNA, it's been pointed out that DNA has profound mathematical connections to the Chinese system of the I Ching. And I believe this is what you're referring to in your question, right?
That's part of it.
Well, you'll have to tell me what the other part is, because I'm guessing here at where you want to.
The bloodliner, the whole bloodliner.
Bloodline part. All right, we'll get to that too. There are profound connections with the I Ching, and there was an author that I was reading when I started investigating that aspect of things, who pointed out that it appears that whoever constructed the I Ching way back when in China had some sort of knowledge, very detailed knowledge, of the effect of things like planetary positions on, so to speak, the individual human program, okay? And the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching match very definitely to some of the genomes in the human genome. Now, the other part of this, and I talk about this in the new book that's coming out, is this idea of bloodlines. And this has gone through endless permutations on the internet, in popular literature. Dan Brown, of course, the Da Vinci Code, all of this stuff is out there.
No, I can tell you from personal experience, this is real.
Oh, yeah.
The bloodlines is unbelievably important. And I can't tell you why. All I can tell you is, there are two classes. There's bloodliners and not bloodliners. And,
right.
the wall has gotten a lot more porous in the last 30 years. But, when I was growing up, it was ironclad.
Well, let me clue people in, if they're interested in this topic, to a book I've already talked about this aspect of things a little bit in Babylon's Banksters. I talk about it in another book called The Cosmic War, which is a very important book in my series of books. And I talk about it again in another book and in a different way in a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And in this book coming out in a couple of months called Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age, I talk about this apparent fixation that some families have with maintaining their bloodline. Now, I talk about it in this sense that it has been a consistent assertion within certain researchers and in a certain community that these bloodlines exist and that they intermarry and they carry out their policy accordingly. I have not until very recently, in doing the research for this book, found any sort of consistent proof of this. When I was doing Babylon's Banksters, I ran into an assertion that the Rothschild family supposedly, and again, I say assertion because I was unable to find any corroboration of the one individual who made this assertion. But I included it in the book for a very important reason, and I'm about to tell your listeners what it is. The Rothschild family, according to the assertion, dates itself to the biblical figure of Nimrod. Okay? Now, when I first read this, Catherine, I thought this cannot be because, a Jewish family is not going to want to associate itself with one of the high villains of the Old Testament. it didn't compute, let's put it that way. So I thought, that's interesting, but I couldn't put the idea down. I couldn't get rid of it. It was so out there. It was so outlandish that I could never let it go. So I kept digging and digging. And I found something very interesting. There was a Rothschild born to the British branch of the family in the 1920s who was named Nimrod. And I had again to ask myself, what is a Jewish family? You would expect them to be named Daniel or Samuel or Joseph or Moses or, a Jewish name.
Right.
Okay, but not right. Nimrod. But there he was, Nimrod so-and-so Rothschild. Okay. I have to tell you, Catherine, when I saw that, I sat here in my office with my jaw just kind of hanging open. So I kept digging, and I ran into a financial group that is a Rothschild financial group called the Nimrod Fund. I believe it's a mutual fund of some sort, but it's actually named the Nimrod Fund. And again, I thought, well, this is kind of loose corroboration in a certain way of what this man had asserted that I had read. Beyond that, I haven't found anything until this book coming out. And I don't want to give away too many details until people can actually sit down and read the book. But I can say this, that it is clear, it is absolutely clear, it is undeniable that there are goings-on during the Middle Ages that cannot be accounted for by any standard textbook explanation because they are too coincidental. When you see the family connections recurring in the new book over and over and over and over again, you cannot come away from reading this data set with any other impression than that these families are indeed closely intermarried. They're carrying out some sort of intricate agenda that they all know or that they all share or that has been communicated to them through their own family ties down through the ages. It is very clear. It's like looking at the Middle Ages version of the Warren Report. You can read a textbook on medieval history and it's going to read like the Warren Report. It's not going to make any sense. But then you dig into the Warren Commission and look at all the evidence and start connecting dots and voila, it's there. So yeah, you know, Lee Harvey didn't shoot from the sixth floor of the book depository with a misaligned telescopic sight on an Italian
wall. And his bullet didn't take a U-turn.
The bullet didn't make a U-turn. Yes. We're dealing with precisely the same sort of phenomenon. And I was kind of gratified in finishing this new book because it did confirm in a certain sense the assertions of many people in the alternative community that these families are old, they're interrelated, and they are that there's a glass barrier. Now, let me speculate for your listeners as to why I think they might be doing this. And I lay this argument out. I'm simply kind of epitomizing it here, but I lay this argument out in my book, The Cosmic War. If you go back and read certain Mesopotamian, Ugaritic, Egyptian texts and read them without the conditioning of academia, read them for what they are. If you read the so-called Babylonian creation epic, which is called the Enuma Elish, the academics tell you it's a creation epic. Sit down and read it as a war epic, because what it's describing is a war. It's not describing creation. If you read another Babylonian text called the Epic of Ninurta, again, you're reading a war epic, and it's almost, I defy people to read this, and I put the whole thing in The Cosmic War, all 9 pages of this so-called epic, so that people could actually sit down and read it, because you cannot come away from a reading of it with the idea that this is a mythology. It's like sitting down to read the Sears catalog or Webster's dictionary.
Right. Right.
It's bland, it's dry, and all it is an inventory of technologies. And the technologies are called the Tablets of Destiny, all right? And in Mesopotamian mythology, these Tablets of Destiny, and I'm citing the actual phrase that these epics use in referring to them, they contain, quote, all the power of the universe, unquote. And the gods are fighting over possession of these things, and when they get them, they use them, okay? So in other words, we're dealing with some sort of technology. And here's the thing. If you pay close attention to the descriptions of these technologies, and you find similar descriptions in Egyptian texts, Ugaritic texts, and so on, You come away with the feeling that these technologies can only be activated in near proximity or actual physical contact with their possessors. And I speculate that these technologies may somehow have been genetically activated or accessed, kind of like a retinal scan that let you into a bank vault, okay?
Right.
It's something of that nature, I think, that is being described in the declined verbiage of these societies trying to preserve something that has descended to them from ancient times. And they're describing them as best as they can. And I think when you read them with modern lenses, it becomes rather clear that they're describing a high technology that is somehow genetically, possibly genetically activated. So I think putting...
Or just genetically aligned.
Or genetically
aligned.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think this is part, possibly, again, to crawl way out on the twig of speculation here, I think this is part, possibly, of why you see these bloodline groups or dynasties or families, what have you, that are trying desperately to preserve their genetic heritage. And that is because they may understand in some way that we don't that there's technologies out there that can only be activated with a certain kind of genetic key. And, you know, since we're talking about this, Catherine, I'll crawl even further out onto the to the twig of speculation here.
And I'll hold the net.
No, thank you. I'll probably need it. You know, your listeners may think I'm just totally raving mad.
No. You know, we don't know. We're trying to figure it out.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to figure it out, too, and I'm not afraid to speculate. You know, I think this is the problem with so much quackademia. I think you have to. Let me put it this way. I think you have to do this kind of stuff in order to understand some of these ancient texts. I don't think you can understand them in the bland way that we've been taught, and I certainly don't think you can understand the goings-on in the Middle Ages without connecting these dots and seeing the big picture. But I think the other thing here that may be going on with the Human Genome Project, and I've suspected this all along, is that covertly they're looking for something. And I've found a very interesting phenomenon. If you can dig around for this on the internet, one of the groups of people that geneticists like to study are precisely groups of people that have traditions, be they religious, be they philosophical, whatever, of maintaining a certain bloodline tradition. They like to study the Kohanim in the Jewish religion because the Kohanim are, you know, the priestly line. So they like to study the genetics of the Kohanim, and they found very interesting things of genetic consistency in that group. They like to study the royal houses of Europe. There have been genetic studies of the Habsburgs because, again, you're dealing with a very close-knit, interwoven family that's so much a part of the tapestry of European history, so they study them. They've studied the Romanovs, again, you know, the same sort of thing. So it's very interesting to see a kind of loose corroboration of this whole bloodline idea. And like I say, when people sit down and read part one of the new book coming out, I think it will become crystal clear. It will be almost impossible for people to deny that there's something going on here of a bloodline nature. It's crystal clear, and to deny it puts you in kind of the same category of believing the Warren Commission as gospel truth. see any other way of putting it.
So two quick items I want to bring up just to help give a perspective on what's going on in current events. As you know, I get very frustrated with the financial world who wants to look at everything tightly within the financial box, because I don't think you can, you know, if you look at who's governing, they're governing everything as a dynamic system together, not, you know, not just gold or not just food or not just energy. These things are deeply interrelated. And, you know, the physics, I agree with you. I think the physics is driving planets and everything on them. So two things. We watched in the 90s and into the 2000s an effort to just aggregate an enormous inventory of gold into the gold ETFs,
right,
particularly the big one. And so you watch literally the global financial system stockpile, build this huge stockpile of gold, and then overnight, ba-boom, tear it down and transfer it. And of course, you know, the gold bugs have all sorts of explanations about that that relate to totally, you know, the gold market alone. And I'm looking at it, I'm saying, well, wait a minute, did they just make a deal to buy the moon back? Or, you know, what?
Yeah.
You know, when you pool, in the financial world, when you pool a whole lot of assets into one big thing, you're doing that coming into a big securitization or a big purchase.
Right.
And so I'm looking at that and I'm saying, there's something going on here, and I don't think it's just about the gold market. Now, it could just be, you know, we're getting ready to do a global currency, and so we want to rebalance the gold, you know, into the various central banks around the world and create the base of a very powerful new system. It could be, you know, yeah, it could be rebalancing the new currency, but, or, you know, maybe we bought the moon. I don't know.
So you're asking me to speculate on what I think happened to the gold?
Well, but it may not be a financial. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you saw the new movie 2012, but it's what happens is the Western world, you know, the planet's going to die, and so the Western world puts together a huge pool and pays the Chinese to build these arcs. And I thought, oh, maybe, you know, maybe the pool will go and they're paying the Chinese to make the arcs.
Let's put it this way. I'm looking at kind of the same picture. We referred earlier in our discussion tonight about the huge amount of derivatives that are sloshing around in the system, quadrillions of dollars. I think the last estimate I heard was something like $17 quadrillion, which, you know, it's hundreds of times the GDP of the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, I'm thinking electrical circuits here. You're putting all this electricity into the system. Where's the load end? We should be seeing enormous effects of this. And I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing them.
No, if anything, you know, you're watching tremendous labor deflation and tremendous deflation on Main Street, all to offset the monetary inflation created by this stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so.
You know, again, where is this going? And then we turn to the gold price, and trust me, if people thought I've crawled way out onto the end of the twig before, I'm going to do so again here in just a few seconds. But the other thing I'm looking at is precisely like you say, gold. We've had this enormous gold story going on for the last 10 years or so. And really, it began maybe 3 to 4 years ago when Baron Blackie stood up in the House of Lords and started talking about gold, and the numbers weren't adding up. And, you know, we haven't heard anything more out of Baron Blackie, and I suspect someone told him to shut up. But again, we're dealing with enormous quantities of gold, and the numbers aren't adding up. We're quoting
right.
This figure here and that figure there, and, you know, Germany has 3,000 tons of gold, but they can only have 5 tons of it back, and it's not good London delivery. And, you know, since when can't we send the Germans their gold?
Right.
All of this suggests that they don't have it. But if that's the case, are they stupid enough to send all of this to China? I don't think so.
No.
I'm just not buying any of the explanations out there. And on top of
I had an uncle who used to teach at West Point, and he said, he had a deep Southern accent, he said, it's stupefying.
It's stupefying. And on top of this, then you get other individuals out there that I think are kind of nuts, claiming that, you know, the Bank of Hawaii has over 100,000 tons of gold in its vault, which, you know, I'm willing to entertain the idea that the amounts of gold may be off by an order of magnitude, but not 2 orders of magnitude.
So before we close, just tell us a little bit more about the new book and how we get it, okay?
Well, hang on. I want the scenario of where all this energy is going. I strongly entertain the speculation, and again, it's high-octane speculation, that this money is somehow going off-world. I don't see any other load end in the monetary circuit here to adequately explain what's going on, or rather, to put it more accurately, the lack of what's going on. And gold itself is very interesting. We discussed this a few days ago. According to some, there is what is called a monatomic state of gold, which exists in a fine powder. And when we say that, we're already dealing with alchemy. So, you know,
right.
I warn people this is going to be high-octane speculation. But in that state, according to the stories, in that state, gold retains all of its chemical properties, but none of its mass properties. In fact, in that state, the heavy metals, platinum, iridium, osmium, gold, and so on, lose approximately 44% of their mass. And in addition, when you attempt to measure the mass of those metals in that state, the scales themselves lose mass. Now, if you're following standard physics, the mass has got to go somewhere. It's just like our money. You know, there has to be a load end on the system. So there's all sorts of theories and speculations out there, but the bottom line of what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with something that, if true, and I'm underlying the subjunctive mood here, if true, the implications are that gold has value precisely because of its anti-gravity properties in that state. And therefore, it would be a commodity in and of itself of value to anyone with the technology that could access that property and utilize it.
Right.
So when you add all this together, no, it's not so out of the picture. I think, again, you have to entertain all possibilities here. Now, that's my wild, speculation for the night. But again, you know, if this is true, then the value of gold is much more than we're being told, and it has a specific reason behind it. So again, would it be something, if we were in contact with somebody that had the technology to utilize it, would that be the medium of exchange? Well, chances are yeah, because they're not going to want gasoline or petroleum to power their spaceships around.
So one of the things I try to get people to, you know, sort of break out of that sort of, you know, those little boxes, I encourage people to read Asimov's Foundation. Because you're talking about, if you're governing at that level, you're talking about using, you know, very dynamic ways. I told you the story about having dinner with an insurance executive, and I said, oh, what are you working on? And he said, oh, well, I'm in charge of doing the research on how memories come from the future. He said, oh, great, the cell towers are creating memories that can come from the future so that the market will, you know, the actuarial tables can be rebalanced. Oh, well, I don't know if you know about the WebBot project, but it's clear, you know, if you talk about mapping the internet, not just the financial data, but the, you know, sort of the discussion, the Facebook kind of discussions,
right.
The, you know, there's enormous information about where things are going to be harvested anyway, but, you know, that idea of inventing your world literally and having a dynamic way of managing ecosystems is very much, you know, I think Asimov's Foundation can get you into thinking the way that these guys think, because that's, they're managing very complex dynamic systems, and they've spent centuries learning how to do it and passing the knowledge down. And, you know, Asimov kind of gets you into that head. So
absolutely, absolutely. Asimov is science fictionalizing the same type of story we've been discussing tonight with
right.
Lawrence Bankster's and the other two books. Absolutely.
He's introducing you to the global governance system.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
He's doing it in a way that's telling you, hey, this may be something galactic. This may be something truly planetary. And the clever thing is when the system starts to break down, he shows you how the decline in the sciences begins to manifest itself. And it's very interesting because it's almost exactly, I'm a huge fan of those books because it's almost exactly what you see happening with these ancient myths once you start to read them as declined and decayed science expressions rather than as simple mythologies or
right.
Babylonian science fiction, so to speak.
Well, Joseph, this has been a wonderful conversation. You know how much I love talking to you.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And we're going to get a chance to speculate. I just want to mention, now your book is available for pre-order because I've ordered it.
Yeah, the book is called Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. And I have to warn people, this is an extremely technical book in the middle part of the book because what I'm trying to do is show the influence of this ancient cosmology on the culture in Western Europe after the Renaissance. So it gets very technical, but it's also historical in the first part in that what I'm trying to do is dig behind the textbook presentations of certain aspects of the Middle Ages and show you that there are deep, deep, huge agendas in play from the financial powers, from these bloodline families, and so on. And I think on that score, I've been relatively successful. I think some people are going to be amazed that the dots that I've connected in this book that have been out there in the public literature, but no one seems to connect them or draw out the huge implications.
Well, you know what the Buddha says. Those who are awake live in a state of constant amazement.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's true.
And then you and I are gonna be together at the Secret Space Conference in June 28th and 29th in San Mateo, and joined by some other fantastic people. So I'm very hopeful that we will.
Dolan will be there. Robert Morningstar, Michael Schratt. If people don't know who Michael Schratt is, he's done just yeoman's work on black technologies, aerospace technologies. Very interesting guy to listen to. But, yeah, we'll be there for that. The book.
And John Rappaport is coming.
Yeah. Oh, he is. Excellent. Good.
Yes, John Rappaport is confirmed he's coming.
Good. Yeah, we'll be there at that conference. The book, like you said, is available for pre-order at Amazon. I'm suspecting, given the usual fast turnaround of that publisher, that it won't be any later than August or early September, possibly even earlier.
Well, good. That gives us time to all read Babylon's Banksters and Financial Vipers of Venice. No, which I recommend strongly.
Oh, yeah. Financial Vipers of Venice... this book is in part deliberately intended to be kind of the hidden text behind the Financial Vipers of Venice. I put certain clues in the Financial Vipers of Venice out there very deliberately to see if anybody would notice them. And then I'm intending this book, particularly in part one, to be the follow-up to the clue that I put out there. So we'll see.
Okay, well, Joseph, before we close, anything else you want to add?
No, that pretty much does it for me. If people want to contact me, they can do so off my website. There's a contact button there. It goes directly to my personal email. The website is www.GizaDeathStar.com. I have blogs that also appear on the website daily, and I do little weekly video updates and so on. So, anybody stopping by, I'm glad to hear from you.
Okay. Well, Joseph, you have a wonderful evening. Good night.
You too.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this Solaria Report. And thank you for joining us. Have a good evening.